Good day and welcome to the Fakery Drinker Audiocast, the Secure Act and Discussion of the Safe Harbor for Selecting Guaranteed Income Conference Call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Fred Reich. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much. And hello, everybody. Welcome to the program. This is a program on the Secure Act provisions on the Safe Harbor for Selecting Guaranteed Income Products for qualified defined contribution plans. We have a bit of an all-star cast for you. We have Brad Campbell, partner in our Washington, D.C. office and former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor, the outfit that will be writing the regulations for this part of the Secure Act. We also have Bruce Ashton, a partner with a law firm here in Los Angeles. And we have Josh Walbesser, a partner from the law firm in our Chicago office, who was at one point in the past also with the Department of Labor. And then, of course, this is Fred Reich, and I'm a partner in the Los Angeles office as well. A couple of housekeeping matters. One, we'll take questions at the end. We're going to limit them, though, to questions related to guaranteed income issues. Some of you all sent in questions ahead of time that were on other matters, and we'll pick those up in future calls or webinars, but that's not today. Today's guaranteed income. Also, this is being recorded, and for those of you who want to listen to it, we will be sending out notices once it's posted on our website, and there'll be a link where you can get to the recording, or you can have some of your associates at work, if you want to, let them listen to it. It's available to you all. Finally, on the housekeeping matters, there are no written materials. We're going to do something a little bit different here. The idea today is to have a conversation about it and to get different perspectives and to have four different attorneys going back and forth on how they see things, not just how they see the law, but how they see this playing out in the real world. So we're going to have a conversational approach rather than one of those PowerPoint-driven approaches. With that in mind, from my perspective, there are actually four things we're going to talk about today. One is the safe harbor for the selection of the insurer to provide guaranteed income inside defined contribution plans. Another may surprise you a little bit. It's what I'm going to call the unsafe harbor provisions in the safe harbor. That is, what are the things you have to look out for and that fiduciaries still need to pay attention to, even though they have a safe harbor? Next will be the portability of benefits. What if you have a guaranteed benefit inside of a 401k plan, say, and then the plan sponsor decides to stop offering a guaranteed benefit generally or that particular guaranteed benefit? How can the participants preserve the guarantee that they've been paying for? And then the fourth is the projection of retirement income, which we see as closely associated with guaranteed benefits because the projection produces a monthly payment in retirement. And it would be pretty obvious to a participant to say, well, gee, if I'm going to have if these projections, these numbers I'm getting on my quarterly statements are of income in retirement, how do I produce that income in retirement? So we see it all as being tied together. With that introduction, let me turn to Bruce Ashton to start us off. And Bruce, you and I have talked about the safe harbor part, the thing everybody's calling the safe harbor for the selection of an insurer in the Secure Act. Could you start us off and tell us what that safe harbor is, what it covers, why we have it, what the effective date is, and then we'll drill down a little further once you're done with those introductory comments. Bruce?
Yes, sir. Thank you, and good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here to talk about the safe harbor. And I'm going to focus on what Fred referred to as the safe harbor part. And the safe harbor in the Secure Act applies to selecting a guaranteed lifetime income contract for a plan. And let me start off just defining that. It's an annuity contract or any other contract that provides guaranteed benefits for at least the remainder of the life of a participant. For example, that could include a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit contract would be one of the other contracts that they're talking about. Basically, under the safe harbor, a plan sponsor is deemed to have acted prudently when it selects the carrier for one of these guaranteed lifetime income contracts, so long as it follows steps outlined in a checklist that's in the statute. In essence, what this means is that the plan sponsor, the fiduciaries, the committee of the plan are not liable if the insurance company later on defaults on its obligation to pay the benefits to the participants. The checklist identifies specified representations that the sponsor needs to obtain from the insurance company about their own financial soundness. And my assumption is, quite frankly, that the insurance companies will have a package of checklist items available just for the asking. By the way, the effective date of this provision in the SECURE Act is now. It's effective now. There's no other effective date specified, so it's effective as of the date of enactment. Basically, the checklist requires written representations from the insurer on a number of different items. First, that it's licensed to offer guaranteed retirement income contracts. That's pretty essential, I think. Second, at the time of selection and for the immediately preceding 7 plan years, the insurer meets certain requirements. First, that it operates under a certificate of authority that has from its in the state where it's organized, and that hasn't been revoked or suspended. So it has to say, yes, we're operating under a valid certificate of authority. It's filed all of its audited financial statements. It has to represent that it maintains statutory reserves in all states where it does business. And it has to represent that it's not operating under an order of supervision, rehabilitation, or liquidation. That's something that I refer to as an adverse order. The next item on the checklist is a representation that the insurer undergoes a financial examination by the insurance commissioner of the state where it's organized at least once every 5 years. And finally, it has to represent that it will notify the plan sponsor of any change in circumstances occurring after it provides the representations that would make it impossible to confirm the representations at the time of issuance of the contract. In other words, they give the representations on day one when they're contacted about, are you a suitable insurer? And they have to confirm in that set of representations that they make at the outset, I'll tell you if anything changes if you select my product, and at the time the product is issued, I'll alert you if there's been any change in circumstances. One other element about the safe harbor is that it says that after receiving these written representations from the insurance company, and before it makes its decision, the plan sponsor or the fiduciaries must not have received any notice of an adverse order affecting the insurer and must not have any other information that would cause it to question those representations. In other words, put that in more plain English, if they have anything that suggests that the representations they've received aren't true, if they have received information that says the representations are not true, they can't take advantage of the safe harbor. In fact, they lose the safe harbor. The good news about the safe harbor is that the plan sponsor is not required to verify any information provided by the insurer. They don't have to dig into its financial condition or its regulatory status. They're only required to obtain these written representations as to the facts, and they don't and must not have any information to the contrary. So that's
Bruce, let me jump in here.
Sure.
Let me jump in for 1 second on this. They I hope people aren't trying to take notes like crazy of all those requirements. They're going to be checklists that people can get that will have this on them. But that Congress, in adopting this checklist report, to saying, gee, you got to gather this information. In the real world, how do you think that's going to happen? How are plan committees or fiduciaries going to collect these several items of information that are required on the checklist? And to reiterate what you were saying, they only have to collect them, but they got to make sure they actually collect the specific things. It appears they don't even have to read them other than reading them enough to make sure they got what's required to get. And so how are they going to get this? Who's going to help them get it? How are they going to know they got the right item? So real world, how's this going to work?
Yeah, well, my assumption is, and I think it's a fair assumption, is that the advisors that they work with in selecting investments for the plan will be providing this kind of information. They'll get it from the advisor will get it from the insurance company. They'll ask for their package of checklist items and will provide that information to the plan sponsor. I would think that the advisor that's on its game will have literally a written checklist, you know, that lists the seven or eight items that they're supposed to get, and so that the plan sponsor can look at their written checklist from the advisor, they can look at the package of materials they got from the insurance company, and literally check the box next to each of the checklist items on the list, and to verify, yes, I've gotten the information I'm supposed to get. So I think it's going to be advisors that are going to be helping them. Insurance companies may also provide literally a checklist with the items that they provide. So it could be.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that the insurance companies are going to put together a package so that all the advisor or the plan sponsor has to say is, hey, I'm interested in your guaranteed products. And they'll say, here's our package. Here's our checklist package. Exactly. In other words, it's not going to be as complex as it sounds in the legislation. And even in the legislation, it sounds pretty simple.
Yes.
Did I get it?
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Okay. I'm going to ask Brad. Let me flip over to Brad and ask Brad a question from a policy perspective on this, because Brad is inside the Beltway. And Brad, you know, as I look at this, it just seems to me that Congress is saying, hey, we're effectively saying the state insurance regulators are enough. As long as the plan fiduciaries make sure or get information that says that the insurance company is in good standing, et cetera, we, Congress, as a policy matter, are going to rely on the state insurance regulators. Yet, Brad, I think all of us on the call have heard, at the least, that the quality of insurance regulation varies dramatically from state to state, with some being very demanding and some less so. What are the politics and the policy behind this, Brad?
Yeah, that's a great point, Fred, because we actually did a regulation providing a safe harbor at the Department of Labor back in 2008. And in full disclosure, that was when I was running the agency, so let me now criticize my own work. The regulation we put out was not useful ultimately. While it provided a safe harbor, it was too difficult to know whether you were within the requirements of it, if you had met the conditions. So it said things like appropriately consider the ability of the insurer to carry out its obligations under the contract, and if necessary, hire an expert to assist in that engagement. So part of what Congress was reacting to is a long series of complaints that, you know, the existing safe harbor is just too nebulous, and we don't know when or if we should hire an expert. We don't know what experts to hire. You know, how much process do we have to do to address this solvency question, for example? So that was one issue that Congress was trying to address, is to make the solvency box-checking exercise literally a box-checking exercise, that you could rely on the representations of the carriers based on the state insurance commissioners. Another bit of history there is, following 2008 and 2009 and all the financial issues, what was called into question was the validity of rating agencies. And there's actually some statutory language out there that prevent agencies from relying on those third-party, you know, credit ratings, so to speak. So DOL couldn't just amend its own regulations to say, Well, one way to do this objectively would be to say, you know, what does an insurance carrier rating company say about it? If their rating is, you know, whatever the right nomenclature is or better, then you can rely on that. The agencies literally couldn't do that. So Congress is in this, in the SECURE Act, in this provision, trying to provide a way for plans to have some clarity. Now, you're right, I think, that there is some question about the evenness of state insurance regulation, but I think as a policy matter, Congress decided having plans adopt more annuitization was a higher priority than trying to be worried about whether some states were as good as others, and this was the most expedient way to do that. There's one other point I would want to make here, just so we're clear about this. The safe harbor, you know, we were talking about the checklist, the information package that likely will come from insurers. All of that, I think, is accurate and true, but it's important to know, as you said earlier, Fred, what the safe harbor doesn't cover. And so while all of that is true and I think relatively simple for the insurance carrier, that doesn't mean that's the limit of what the plan has to do in prudently selecting the carrier it wants to go with.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. And I'll come back to some of those other points with you, Brad, in a couple of minutes. I got a couple of questions left for Bruce, though. Bruce, you were referring to the language that says that the fiduciaries cannot be in possession of other information which would cause the fiduciaries to question the representations provided. When I first read that, I thought, oh, my God, if something's on the Internet, are the fiduciaries assumed to know that, like a lawsuit or a state action of some kind? But then in reading it again, it says the for this to apply, the fiduciaries have to be in possession. I assume we'll get regulations on this at some point, but my reading now, my thinking is that means they actually have to have it. It's not actual knowledge, not, oh, my goodness, something's out there that they should have known. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. I think if it's a know or should know requirement, then I think hopefully that would have been specified in the statute. But yeah, I read it the same way you do, that if they have to actually have the information in their possession in order for them to be charged with knowledge that the representations they've gotten are not true.
Good answer, Bruce. agreeing with Fred is a good answer.
yes, I understand that.
okay. Hey, Bruce, one more thing. Let's go back. You know, an earlier provision says that the fiduciaries also, in addition to that, have to engage in an objective, thorough, and analytical search for the purpose of identifying insurers from which to purchase such contracts. You know, at first that threw me. They have to figure out every insurance company out there that does it. And then I realized that language is pretty similar to what you see for mutual funds. You know, that they've got to engage in an objective, thorough, and analytical search for mutual funds, which is generally interpreted as meaning, you know, you got to look at a broad enough selection that you know what's going on and you have a robust group where you can select good things from it. So that's sort of where I'm leaning now. What do you think about that language, Bruce?
Yeah, you know, when I first looked at it, I thought, that seems a little inconsistent with the notion of a safe harbor. If you have to do an analytical search for purposes of finding the carrier, but then you can rely on representations, aren't those a little bit inconsistent? But I think you're probably right that what the and here I am agreeing with Fred again, that what they're getting at is that the plan sponsor, the plan committee, needs to investigate the marketplace a little bit. Okay, who's out there selling these kinds of products, and who should we be looking to get the representations from? So I think it's probably the focus is on the aspect of looking at the marketplace, understanding the marketplace, and then going out and asking for the representation package, the checklist package.
Okay, so Bruce, let me flip on you here and go from the law that we all know a lot about over to the future and predictions. which our crystal ball is no better than anybody else's, but let's take a chance. In terms of plan sponsors, including guaranteed income products in their plans, Bruce, what do you think is going to happen now that this legal change has occurred?
Well, I think in the short term, it will calm the jitters of some plan sponsors, and they'll feel more comfortable if they think about offering an annuity product or some other form of guaranteed lifetime income product in their plan. But I think they'll still have to be sold on the need and the appropriateness of including such a product in the plan. So I think it's not going to result in 2020 in a wholesale adoption of these types of products and plans in the short term. I think in the longer term, there's a chance that it will become more of the norm and less of a hard sell that I think it will be in the near term. When I say hard sell, it's going to be a somewhat easier sell than perhaps it has been in the past because of the safe harbor in terms of selecting the carrier, because I think that's frankly been a barrier among perhaps others, but that in itself was a barrier in terms of, oh my gosh, am I going to be responsible for selecting a carrier that will in fact be around in 20 or 30 or 40 years, and am I going to get sued 20 years from now because the carrier went out of business, even though there was no indication today that it might? So that, I think that's one of the things that the safe harbor does, is it calms that fear. So I think in the long term, it will. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Josh and Brad, what do you guys think? You see it the same as Bruce, a little bit different? What's your crystal ball say?
Yeah, I would maybe tie together something that Bruce said and something that Brad said. I mean, I think that this is certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, the new safe harbor we have is a safe harbor. It's an objective safe harbor. To replace the rather subjective quasi-safe harbor that we had before. But I think that there's a lot of work to be done. I mean, this sort of opens the path as an industry to educate people on the benefits of lifetime income. But I think that there's still a lot of convincing that needs to happen, both at the plan sponsor slash fiduciary level and the individual participant level. I mean, there's still, frankly speaking, a lot of distrust of annuities and insurance companies generally, and maybe even more so just misunderstandings about the benefits. I mean, for example, if you take someone who has $1 million in their 401k plan and you look at what that converts to in terms of an annuity or another lifetime form of income, it doesn't seem that attractive to people. In other words, people don't necessarily have a really good perspective on, say, what's a safe annual withdrawal rate in retirement that'll keep you that'll make sure you don't run out of money in retirement. So I would say, I think, again, it's a step in the right direction, but we have a lot of education to do.
Well, this is Brett. I would agree. Also, I do think this does address a real concern, but this is not the sole concern. So I think this is a step forward, especially in conjunction with the other elements that are in the SECURE Act related to guaranteed income, and therefore it's helpful, and therefore I think it will be an incentive both for plans to consider those products and also for carriers and others to develop and promote more and more products. And I think that's one of the things that ought to be emphasized about this, is because the safe harbor is very flexible as to what a guaranteed retirement income contract is, it does permit a wide array of product offerings. So those could be, potentially those could include things like longevity annuities or, as you said, Bruce, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit annuities. There's a lot of different potential structures here. And I think that's where probably the next phase of work will focus. You know, Fred, to answer your question about the long term, is continuing to develop products that really appeal to this particular ERISA plan participant marketplace.
Yeah, I agree with all of you guys. I think it's going to take a little while to get the momentum built up. I think that we could see some new interesting, transparent, institutionally priced products. I think there is a huge need for guaranteed lifetime income, particularly for the middle class, you know, the people for whom Social Security does not make up a big percentage of the retirement income, but who need income that will still be producing at age 90, 95, 100. Last year, a little over a year ago, my mom died at 101. And I mean, that's from age 65 to 101, 36 years. That's a long time to make a $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 IRA last. And an annuity could give some financial security there. The only thing I would really add, other than that summary of your comments, the only thing I would add to that is if I were in the insurance industry and I had a really good product, I think I would spend time now primarily educating advisors and working with advisors rather, and plan sponsors would be secondary, because I see advisors or consultants as sort of the gateway to plan committees. And I think if they find a product that is high quality, well-priced, institutional, because 401ks expect institutional, then I think that would be the pathway to success over the longer haul. Let me segue, in the interest of time, Brad, over to you. I said earlier that there was a safe harbor, and then there was an unsafe part of the safe harbor. And that's the part where it says that the safe harbor for selection of the insurer does not cover the cost of the product relative to the feature, and the cost has to be reasonable relative to the features. Could you take a, I mean, that's just a rough view of it. Could you take us into a little more detailed analysis of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we were alluding to earlier, I think the part the safe harbor very clearly addresses and does a good job of addressing is the solvency of the carrier, the ability of this insurance provider to meet its requirements in the future. We now have a really easy, user-friendly answer to that. But that doesn't mean that you don't have to otherwise prudently select and, to a certain extent, monitor the, and there's some difference exactly how that applies. But you definitely have to go through a prudent, as it says at the beginning, a prudent, thorough, objective, thorough, and analytical search to identify insurers and to identify products. And so I think we're not off, this doesn't provide a safe harbor against what you would think of as the ordinary prudent process for making an investment decision for a plan. So it helps with elements of it, but it doesn't eliminate that requirement or otherwise make you immune from liability for not following that process correctly. And one of the issues to consider there is cost. Now, as in other places, cost is not the ultimate factor that you consider in making an investment decision. It is a factor. It is a relevant factor amongst a variety of relevant factors. And so they note that in the safe harbor, that you do have to specifically look at costs and take those into account, and that the cost has to be reasonable. And here, I think, what we're likely to see, I think, is the Labor Department, either through guidance or regulation, clarify that for the purposes of this safe harbor, reasonable means the same thing it does when we ordinarily consider reasonable in the context of ERISA, that it doesn't mean you have to pick the cheapest option. It doesn't mean there's only one price. And, in fact, the safe harbor also says you don't have to pick the cheapest option, just reiterating that point. But you have to have gone through a process that allows you to determine that in light of the features and benefits of this annuity, of whatever this product is, that the costs are reasonable in light of those. So it does create a zone of costs. And this is really a market-based approach. Generally speaking, we would look at doing an RFP process, a request for proposal process, whether you're hiring a service provider, whether you're looking at investments. You would look at what's the marketplace for these services, what's the range of prices we would pay, and is this particular quote for this particular investment or this particular carrier, this guaranteed retirement income contract that we're looking at, is it reasonable in light of what else is available in the marketplace and its particular features and benefits? And again, you can take into account a whole lot of different features. You know, these can be a wide array of products. So there's a lot of flexibility here, but it also means you're going to have to fall back on your, you know, ERISA words that all of us have, you know, had tattooed someplace to be part of the ERISA Guild, which is process and documentation. you're going to have to show your work to show that you did consider the costs and that they were reasonable in light of your process that you undertook to decide which contract to go with and which carriers to review. So I think it's important to note that it's not that this is an unusual new requirement. I think it is in many ways the same requirement that we're accustomed to, but it also means that the safe harbor has some limited applicability to that ordinary, what I would call ordinary prudence analysis.
Yeah, you know, Brad, for example, I've got a fair amount of experience with guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefits, GMWBs. The ones that are in 401k plans now generally are wrapped around a target date fund, although they could be wrapped around a balanced fund. And depending on the nature of the guarantee, they cost somewhere between 60 basis points and 100 basis points a year. So they're entirely transparent. They can be dropped at any time. There's no surrender charge for dropping them or market value adjustment or anything like that. It's just a wrapper that you can have when you want and you don't have to have. So the range is established by the market between 60 and 100 basis points per year. And as I look at the differences in what's guaranteed by the 60 basis point one versus the 100 basis point, you can see there are some significant differences that where the 100 basis point has more guarantees. For example, the guarantee of setting the withdrawal base at the high watermark may continue post-retirement in the more expensive one, but in and at retirement in the less expensive one. So there, where I've had my most experience, you can see that a range of reasonableness has already developed. And I assume that with information like that, there'll be benchmarking services that'll provide information for each of the different types of guaranteed products that emerge as a result of this. But let me turn to Josh for a second. Josh, you sit with plan committees. What do you think how do you think a plan committee is going to deal with this reasonable cost issue?
You made the point, Fred, earlier about use of advisors. I would say that that's going to be an important step. I mean, I think most plan committees, when they're considering something like this, will do an RFP. Most reasonably well-run plan committees will do an RFP and get somewhere between, say, 3 and 7 or 8 bids. But I think that they will rely somewhat on investment advisors as well to weigh in on the reasonableness of the cost.
Yeah. Bruce and Brad, any thoughts on how people will manage this?
Yeah, I think this is Bruce. I think what Brad said earlier, or maybe it was you, about getting benchmark reports will be an important element of comparing costs of the different contracts. And, you know, the statute talks about cost in relation to product features and administrative services to be provided. And I think you were alluding to that, Fred, when you were talking about the range from 60 to 100 basis points, that when you look at the different GMWB-type products, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit products, they do have different features, and the price of the contract is varies depending on what those features are. So it's important for not only to look at the cost factor, but also to look at, okay, what are you getting for that cost? And I think that's where a benchmarking service that does that kind of comparison would be extremely useful for the advisors to advise their plan committees and for the committees to look at to consider these contracts.
Well, and Fred, this is Brad. You mentioned insurers talking to advisors as the gateway to plans. I think this highlights why that makes sense, because there's going to have to be a process around the selection and a documentation of that process. People might be looking at adopting some language into their investment policy statements to address these types of products. So really, advisors are going to play, I think, a crucial role in figuring out how to evaluate these products to make sure they're in the safe harbor, but also to comply with the parts the safe harbor doesn't protect, which is kind of what I would call the normal prudence factors, or at least arguably doesn't protect. There is some ambiguity, I think, in how the safe harbor is written in that it's for the selection of a contract rather than a carrier. So maybe it is a little broader in its application, but that's something that I think when DOL does regulations and guidance, which I think it probably will, just because I think there are questions as to how to read the statute given some of the peculiarities of its language, that we may have more clarity on.
Good. But hey, Josh, let me segue over to you. There's that portability provision I mentioned in the introductions. So I'm going to sort of throw this wide open to you. What is the portability provision? Why do we have a portability provision? And what's the effective date? So go, Josh.
All right. Thanks, Fred. And by the way, we're talking now about Section 109 of SECURE, if anyone's interested in the site. Unfortunately, the language in the statute is a little complicated. So, but the short practical answer as to portability is that this new provision allows certain defined contribution plans to recognize what I'll call a new distribution event for participants with respect to a lifetime income investment. And that lifetime income investment is a defined term that I'll hit on in just a minute. So now this is permissive. It's not required. For sponsors who are interested in it, the effective date has already come and gone. It's effective now after December 31st of 2019. Again, not required. But for plans that choose to adopt this, to be clear, what we're talking about here is an in-service distribution. So there's no need to hit age 59 and a half. There's no reason to, there's no need to leave your job to die, become disabled, so on. So what does trigger this new special distribution right? So this is when a lifetime income investment on the plan, available on the plan, will no longer be an option available under the plan. And these special distributions of lifetime income investments will be allowed during the 90-day period immediately prior to removal of that lifetime income option. And there are actually two types of distributions. One is that the lifetime income investment can be distributed to the participant in the form of an annuity. The second is that it can be rolled over directly, in other words, in what we call a trustee-to-trustee transfer, to another eligible retirement plan, and that includes not only a qualified plan or 403B, but also an IRA. And notably, the second type here is not restricted, at least on its face, to an annuity contract. So just to jump into the details a bit, I might divide this up into sort of three simple questions. First is, why does it exist? What's the policy reason behind it? What's the problem we're trying to solve? The second is what products are going to be covered. In other words, what's going to fall into this lifetime income investment bucket? And the third is what plans can take advantage of it. So on the first question, why do we want this? And Fred, you kind of touched on this a little bit. Historically, plan sponsors have been hesitant to adopt lifetime income options for a number of reasons. Now, of course, we've talked about some of those. But let's say a plan sponsor or fiduciary is able to get comfortable in the past with the cost, believes that they have a good quality product, believes they have a good, high-quality solvent insurer, there's still the problem of getting rid of the product if you ever want to at the plan level. In other words, you can't get rid of it generally at the plan level. Because if you do, you're one of two things, or maybe both, is going to happen. You're either going to lose the lifetime income benefit for participants, or you may end up paying surrender charges or possibly both. And that can, of course, come up in a number of scenarios. You could have a plan sponsor who changes their mind about having the lifetime income product. They could change their mind about the product they have. They might think, we have a better option now, a less expensive option, a different company. Or the plan sponsor could get bought, by another company, could lose control of the plan. And maybe even most notably, we should point out that different record-keeping platforms won't necessarily support all lifetime income options. Obviously, one vendor is not generally going to support on its platform a competing vendor's product. So in a sense, if you have a lifetime income, or at least in the past, if you had a lifetime income product in your plan lineup, in a sense, you were somewhat married to that vendor, to that record keeper. If you ever wanted to leave, which could be for reasons, of course, unrelated to the lifetime income product, you have a choice. You either have to give it up, or I suppose you could sort of split the plan and move most of the plan to the new record keeper and keep the old one just for the purpose of the lifetime income, but that would obviously create a lot of headaches and a lot of additional costs. So basically, this new distribution event allows us to solve this problem at the participant level rather than at the plan level. In other words, by giving the lifetime income product to the participant in one form or another. So second question, what are these lifetime income products that are going to qualify here? And I'm paraphrasing a little bit here. But a lifetime income investment must give the participant an election right. It has to be an election right that's different than the other options in the plan. There's basically two forms. There's one that's an annuity that's payable at least annually, at least for the life of the participant or the joint life of the participant and a designated beneficiary. Of course, that's normally going to be the surviving spouse. Or the second is a product that guarantees a minimum level of income at least annually, again, for the life of the participant or joint life of the participant and a beneficiary like a spouse. So what we're talking about here is going to be insured products, or at least what I'll call hybrid products that have an insured dimension. And you can sort of, with respect to any product, you can sort of look at that test to figure out whether it's something that's going to qualify or not. For example, a managed payout fund is not, obviously. It's not a guaranteed product. They're designed to provide payouts for life, but there's no guarantee. And even within guaranteed insured products, it's important to emphasize that it has to be a life benefit or a joint life benefit. For example, we talked about guaranteed withdrawal benefits. A guaranteed withdrawal benefit, say, that just practically works for 20 years or something like that, will not qualify. Again, it's not a life benefit. It's not a joint life benefit. So our third question then is, what kind of plans can take advantage of this? What kind of plans can have these distribution rights? So very quickly, we're talking about qualified profit sharing and other defined contribution plans, 401k plans, 403b plans, and governmental 457b plans. So basically, it's all of the plans that qualify under the normal rollover rules in the code, but they have to be defined contribution, not defined benefit. And this sort of, in a sense, brings us full circle to my first comment, because, again, the language in the statute is kind of technical, and the reason is that these different plan types each have their own little idiosyncrasies and differences with respect to distribution. So it's a lot of technical updates to a lot of different provisions in the code. Again, this is effective now. You can put it in right now if you'd like to. It is optional. It's not required. And just one final comment is that, and this, of course, is consistent with current law, but just to be clear, there's also no requirement for another plan to accept rollovers in of lifetime income investments from another plan. So it's optional, if you will, at multiple levels.
Hey, Josh, thank you very much. Let me segue to Brad now. And in about 5 or 6 minutes, we're going to go to questions and answers. So get your questions ready. We'll open up the lines then. Not now, but we're going to let Brad go first. Brad, I looked at the provisions in the law mandating retirement income projections, and they struck me as being somewhat similar to the federal thrift plan's projections of lifetime income. And, of course, you've been a participant in the federal thrift plan, so you know how that works, and you've had some real-life experience with us. Why don't you walk us through the mandate, the requirement, when it's going to be effective, and how it looks to you, having had some experience in the area, what your reaction and experience has been. So, Brad?
Yeah, and I think, Fred, you put your finger on one of the biggest questions that we don't really know the answer to yet, and there is some ambiguity in how it's written, which is, what is it that's actually going to be projected? So what the provision in the law does, and it's Section 203, Lifetime Income Disclosure, and what it says is that within a 12-month period, you have to provide at least once, the plan administrator has to provide at least once, as a new addition to the pension benefits statement. Obviously, that's quarterly for participant-directed plans, annually for non-participant-directed plans. But at least once in that 12-month period, you have to provide a lifetime income disclosure. And a lifetime income disclosure, it sets forth the lifetime income stream equivalent of the total benefits accrued with respect to the participant or beneficiary. The lifetime stream equivalent has two components. One is a qualified joint and survivor annuity in which the spouse is assumed to be the same age as the participant, and the second is a single life annuity. So in other words, you're going to have to disclose on an annual basis the lifetime income that would be both the qualified joint and survivor and the individual annuity. The discretion as to what assumptions go into making that disclosure is basically passed on entirely to the secretary. It says that these lifetime income streams are based on assumptions specified in rules prescribed by the secretary, and there is also a model disclosure the secretary is supposed to put out that would provide certain explanations that this is only an illustration, that would explain that the actual payments may vary substantially from this illustration, explain all the assumptions on which these lifetime stream income equivalents were determined, and provide such other similar explanations as the secretary considers appropriate. In terms of when it goes into effect, it really depends on when the Labor Department finishes work that it has to do under this rule. And there are three things the Labor Department has to do. They have to issue interim final rules that will describe how this works. They have to issue the model disclosure, and they have to issue the assumptions that are going to be used. And they have 12 months from enactment, so due this December, to do all three of those things. And the effective date is that the benefit statements will be the ones that it will apply to the benefit statements that's furnished more than 12 months after the latest of the issuance of the secretary of those three items. So in other words, the last of those three, the secretary gets out the door, starts a requirement that 1 year later you will then have to provide the disclosures. So the secretary has 1 year to develop these documents and rules, and then 1 year later they become applicable the way the statute's written. But to your point, Fred, what really comes with this – oh, and there's one other point I really need to emphasize because it has actually a very good liability limitation. It says no plan fiduciary, plan sponsor, or other person shall have any liability solely by reason of the provision of lifetime income stream equivalents, which are derived in accordance with the assumptions and rules that the secretary puts out and includes the explanations contained in the model disclosure the secretary puts out. So this does address one of the concerns people have had about these proposals is, you know, these are projections. They may prove to be wildly wrong depending on how the assumptions and reality match up. What's the liability here? And there is a very good provision that basically limits that liability. The secretary has wide latitude under this statute to define what the assumptions are. They can issue a single set of assumptions, which could be effectively a table that we would just sort of mechanically apply, or they can allow ranges of assumptions. And I think one of the first questions, and again going back to what you alluded to, Fred, is does this language require the secretary to only look at the currently accrued benefit? And I think there's just enough ambiguity. There is a question as to whether the secretary could say, nope, the statute requires me to say we're going to base these projections on your account balance today. Or the secretary, I think, could find the authority to say, oh, we're going to make assumptions that roll those balances forward to your retirement age and then make a projection from that. And I think it's going to be very much up to the secretary, which they do. About the Thrift Savings Plan, the federal government makes these projections currently for people who are participants in basically the government's 401k, and I get this annually myself. I have to say, Fred, my experience has been that if it's based on my current account balance, and it pretends that I'm retirement age this year when I get it, it's practically worthless to me. Because basically what they do is they say in the thrift savings plan, they say, well, we're going to assume that you're 62 today, which is the age for their particular annuity that's used for that program. And based on that, if you were 62 today, here's the retirement income you would get from that. But since I'm not 62, it doesn't really help me much to have a projection that doesn't really have any meaning to me. So I think not rolling it forward is an issue. On the other hand, the assumptions that go into rolling it forward are substantial. So let me take a step back and say I think it's important for everyone to remember that DOL tried to do something of its own initiative in this area back in around 2010. They put out a request for information to ask how they should do these kinds of projections. And the answers they got back from everyone in, you know, industry, consumer groups, academics, you name it, was really a muddled mess. Almost everyone disagreed with one another as to how best to do this. You would have things like one insurance carrier saying you should roll the balance forward to retirement and then project income, and another carrier would say absolutely not, you should do it based on the account balance as of today. And it's pretty unusual to see major industry players who are normally on the same side of the fence be on opposite sides. So I think DOL has quite a difficult task ahead of it to figure out what assumptions to use, how to do them, and to do that in 12 months, basically by December, now it's less than 12 months, I think is going to be very challenging for the agency. There's also, I think, kind of a weird interplay between the way the statute is written, between DOL putting out rules that provide the assumptions and an interim final rule that governs the process, because one of the elements of the process the interim final rule would address are the assumptions, yet elsewhere the statute treats them as if they were separate. So my suspicion is the DOL will probably use the interim final rule to cover the waterfront of the regulatory side because of the way that's written. And the reason that matters for those of you who don't do regulation speak, and I'm hoping most of you are in that category, an interim final rule is a regulation DOL or other federal agencies can put out, can promulgate, that actually goes into effect and that we have to live with, but on which they're going to take comments and may amend in the future. So it's a special authority to issue a rule that's final in terms of it applies, but isn't final in the sense that it may well be changed in the future. So Congress recognized 12 months was a tall order and gave DOL some enhanced regulatory ability to meet those requirements faster, while still recognizing that the haste might cause them to have to make some adjustments down the road. The bottom line, I think, Fred, is that this is actually a really important provision because it's going to affect how people perceive the value of their defined contribution plans. If I'm a 25-year-old with $5,000 in my account, what assumptions go into telling me what income that produces could have a pretty significant effect on whether I think this is worth doing. Is it going to show that I get $12 a month in retirement income? Or is it going to show that I get $1,200? And the answer depends on what DOL decides in the next roughly 10 months they have left to make those decisions. So I think this is going to be a very interesting and important one for us all to watch, but it's almost entirely up to DOL how they do it.
Thank you, Brad. Nicely done. Operator, will you tell people how to ask us questions?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. We ask that you please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions.
While we're waiting for the first question, just to add to what Brad was saying, looking at this from a best practices perspective rather than a legal perspective, whatever the DOL comes out with, I don't think they will assume future deferrals by the participant or contributions by the employer. In other words, it would just be the account balance, either projected or not. And it seems to me that a best practice approach would be to then have a second projection that says if you keep doing the same thing you're doing now, and if your employer keeps contributing the same match or contributions that they do now, this projects out to so much at retirement. Then it would go on to say something to the effect of what's called gap analysis, that many experts recommend you have 75% income replacement ratio. You're ahead of schedule, you're behind schedule. If you're behind schedule, defer another $25 per paycheck and you're projected to catch up. So I can see this ultimately becoming much more than it is right now, and that the legal requirement will become the first building block, but that it would get more sophisticated and provide better information to participants than the rule itself will alone. Operator, do we have a question?
We'll take our first question.
Hello.
Fred and colleagues, thank you very much for this really informative discussion on the guaranteed income. Probably directed to Fred for starters, in the benefit itself to be put on a plan menu, would it not matter if it was the target date series or the balanced fund, both providing that mechanism of the hedge that can kick in either immediately or 10 years, let's say, prior to retirement? There seem to be very few providers in the marketplace currently. I'm here in Denver, so we have a notable one right here in our locale. And then, of course, when we get back to the marketplace review that your colleagues suggest we need to do, how encompassing does that need to be? What might qualify in terms of numbers? And to your knowledge as a panel, how many providers are out there currently? It doesn't strike me as there are terribly too many. More to come.
Yeah. A couple of quick thoughts on that, and then I'll open it up to the other guy. First, I think we have to free up our thinking and assume that we may not have yet seen or may not yet be in the market the most, what will turn out to be the most popular product. Maybe it'll be a derivative of something we have seen. But that aside, going back to like the target date fund and the wraparound JMWB, I've seen at least three different versions of that in the market. One is where it attaches immediately. That is, the guarantee attaches immediately. The fees are charged immediately. And it could be a 25-year-old, a 45-year-old, or a 65-year-old. Another variation is 10 years before the target date. So let's say that I was going to retire in 2035. My target date fund now wouldn't have a GMWB. It wouldn't have any guarantee, and I wouldn't be charged any fee. But in 2025, when I'm 10 years from the target date, the full amount, the high watermark of the full amount of the target date fund would be have a guaranteed wrap on it, and I would begin to be charged for the full guarantee. That's the second version. The third version is where there's one that I've worked on where 10 years prior to the targeted date, the retirement date, which they use the target date of the fund that most closely corresponds to age 65 typically, but 10 years before that 2035 date in my hypothetical, that is on 2025, 10% of my account would be guaranteed and I would be charged 10% of the fee instead of the whole fee. A year later, 20%, and 20% of the fee. A year later, 30% would be guaranteed, and I would be charged 30% of the fee. And you can see the progression is such that at the target date, 100% of the account would be wrapped by the GMWB, of the target date fund would be wrapped by the GMWB, and I would be charged the full fee from that point forward. By full fee, I mean that 60 to 100 basis points that I talked about earlier. But that's enough about me talking. What about, you know, Brad or Bruce or Josh, you want to augment this and maybe answer anything that I missed?
Well, this is Brad. I'll just jump in with the thought that in general, the interaction of QDIAs and automatic enrollment and various types of guarantees, as Fred said, you can have a wrapper, but there's also been some questions about to what extent can actual, you know, guaranteed investments be included in that, and there's been some back and forth from DOL about whether that fits the QDI regulation or not. I would expect that as we develop more products, we're going to see more pressure on DOL to have QDIAs that accommodate some of these strategies more. I think there's a lot of work that's going to happen over the next, you know, say 5 to 7 years in this space to address kind of all of the issues you raised, and some of it may be new guidance and new regulations beyond the SECURE Act to accommodate some of the changes in the marketplace. This is where I will just throw up the red flag, which is, you know, we have an election coming up in November where we have pretty radically different views on financial services amongst the candidates. So, you know, the election is going to have a big impact on how the SECURE Act is implemented in the short term. If nothing else, if there's a change in administration, the timing for any of these regulations and guidance gets radically changed because a new incoming administration typically locks down the activities of the prior one and then figures out what they want to do differently. But there may also be long-term implications of different philosophies. So Yeah, I just wanted to throw that in there since, we did have the debates last night, and it kind of struck me watching them how different some of these answers could be.
And this is Bruce. Brad, when you talk about work, I assume what you mean is work on both the regulatory side and by the financial services industry in terms of on the regulatory side coming up with the regulations you've been talking about, but on the industry side, some of what Fred was saying of the design of the products and perhaps introduction of new and different products that we haven't seen before. I assume that's what you mean by that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think we're going to see a lot of change both on the provider side, on the industry side in terms of creating new products, but that's also going to put pressure on the regulators to fix things that were adopted 10 or 15 years ago that are no longer appropriate as regulatory decisions or as guidance decisions. So I think we're going to see movement on both sides in order to accommodate some of these products.
Let me add one more comment, and then we'll try one more question because we are out of time. One comment is that, that cost analysis that Bruce and Brad mentioned were required. My gut level reaction is that this is going to be dealt with institutionally. That is, the plan committees are going to look for products designed for institutional. I know there are people who are talking about retail annuities being sold inside plans. I actually think this, what will happen to guaranteed products will be very similar to what's happened to mutual funds, where we have mutual funds, separately managed accounts, institutional share classes, collective trusts, a lot of stuff, high quality with relatively low pricing. I think the guarantees will probably work out the same way because that stuff is woven into the fabric of 401k decision making. Hey, operator, we can take one more question. Is there one?
Thank you. We'll take our next question.
Hello.
Yes, this is Ron Trigloff. I haven't gotten any emails or seen anything in the press regarding any benchmarking firms that are saying they have this service. Have you heard of any?
I don't think so. What about you other guys? And I think it's coming. But I think you need enough products on a platform because they get their data from record keepers for the most part. And
right.
I don't, other than GMWBs, I don't know that there's that much experience so far.
So even though this is available right now, I mean, it really, if we're to do this right, it's not really available.
Well, this is Brad. I would say benchmarking is not the only way to do that. I think if you had a good review process that looked at a number of carriers and looked at the fees directly in response to solicitations, basically, you put out bids and they answered, I think you could get to the same place without a benchmarking survey per se. But I tend to agree with Fred. I think they aren't really fully run up yet because this is a relatively new development, but I do think we'll see more of those. But it's not the only way to assess whether this fee is reasonable.
Okay, thank you.
Operator, actually, we'll take one more if there's one more in the queue.
We have no further questions right now.
Okay, well, thank you. The a parting comment here is that a couple things people don't tend to realize is that I don't think you're going to see guaranteed products from the retail market just all of a sudden show up on 401k platforms. It seems to me that plan sponsors, record keepers, and advisors are all aligned in wanting high-quality, reasonably priced products in 401k plans. And the first step of getting into a 401k plan is getting on a record keeper's platform. So I think record keepers themselves will have filters that, even though Congress selected a check-the-box approach with no analysis required, at least on selection of the insurer, I think that the record keepers are going to be, they're going to want to protect their brand. They're going to offer high-quality, reasonably priced products. And so there will be a process for getting on the platforms that will vet the quality of the insurance companies as well as the cost. So I think there's a whole process out there that will lead to institutional type products, much like what we've seen with 401k plans. Other than that, everybody, thank you so much for attending today. We had over 600 people register. That's a heck of an audience. And we appreciate your interest, and we hope we've done a good job of making your time valuable. So from Fred and Bruce and Josh and Brad, thank you very much, and have a good rest of the day. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.